I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night in Las Vegas, Mike Bloomberg took incoming from all sides at his first Democratic presidential debate. Here's Warren, Sanders, Biden, and Klobuchar.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
Mr. Bloomberg had policies in New York City of stop and frisk, which went after African-American and Latino people in an outrageous way. That is not a way you're going to grow voter turnout.
He has stop and frisk, throwing close to 5 million young black men up against a wall. And when we came along in our administration, President Obama, and said we're going to send in a moderator to a mediator to stop it, he said that's unnecessary.
I think we need something different than Donald Trump. I don't think you look at Donald Trump and say we need someone richer in the White House.
Bloomberg, who is worth more than $60 billion, has spent more than $400 million on campaign ads, largely avoiding questions and criticisms of his record as mayor of New York City. Bernie Sanders is the front runner based on recent polls and defended Medicare for all, his supporters, and socialism. Elizabeth Warren took off the gloves, lobbing most of her attacks at Bloomberg, although she didn't spare some of the other candidates with some belittling comments. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar got personal when they argued over qualifications, experience, and the name of the Mexican president. Joe Biden touted his experience and is struggling to hold on to his supporters, betting his candidacy on states with diverse voters. The person who barely got a mention last night was President Trump, who one of these candidates will face in the general election. We have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times to talk about what happened last night and what it all means. Ryan Cooper is national correspondent for the week. And Ryan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Camille Burge is also back with us as well. She's assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Michael Hagan is with us as well. He's associate professor of political science at Temple University. Michael, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Who do I start with? Where do we start here? Let's start with Mike Bloomberg. And let me start with you, Camille. How did he do last night?
He did himself no favors. As I was texting many people last night, the key takeaway was he probably needs those ads to hide behind those advertisements. I do not think that Michael Bloomberg did well last night. He was unprepared. He seemed incredibly smug, at times very arrogant, and other times completely unrelatable. And so I don't think that he did himself any favors last night. And just the lack of preparation is what I was completely struck by. With all of that money, can you pay some debate prep people? Like it's so
to prepare. Ryan, let me turn to you. One of the things I was reading about Mike Bloomberg is from reporters in New York who have covered him or covered him when he was the mayor, three-time mayor of New York City, is he's not a very good debater. Is that what we learned last night?
Yeah, well, I was not living in New York at that time for most of that time. But you know what? What he reminded me of in some ways was President Obama's first debate in 2012. If you remember that, Obama seemed very rusty. And Bloomberg, to me, seemed like a guy who is surrounded at all times by lickspittles and toadies who never criticize him or force him to listen to anything uncomfortable, you know, because if you're a billionaire, you can just do that. And suddenly you have people just absolutely throwing haymakers at him, and he's totally caught off his guard. And, you know, you could pay people to do debate prep, as you said, but you can't force yourself to listen to it if you're a cloistered plutocrat like Mike Bloomberg.
Well, let me turn to you, Michael Hagan. It's interesting to see the $400 million that Michael Bloomberg has paid for his ad campaign, and obviously gotten some boost in the polls. I think the question is comparing that to his debate performance. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to his popularity going forward.
It certainly will. One of the fundamentals to bear in mind here is that lots of people won't be making that comparison. Lots of people who are seeing the ads didn't watch the debate.
Right.
And the debate was attractive and entertaining to a certain slice of the American electorate.
Whom we're sitting here.
Yes, right. And many more in Nevada than in Super Tuesday states, for example, where the Bloomberg ad campaign is focused. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between those two audiences that, you know, the debate may not cost him all that much in those states. We'll see.
It's so interesting to me, and even beyond Mike Bloomberg, how difficult it is for political people to admit a mistake. I mean, to truly say, I am sorry. I mean, as I said, he's not the only one. I'm looking at you, Camille, but it just seems as if those words are just hard to spit out and mean them.
It's true. I mean, just without even giving it the level of politicians or political elites, think about how hard it is for us on a daily basis to apologize for the mistakes that we make, for the words that we say that we do not mean, for the statements that we did not intend, or at times we might be ill-informed or not have the correct answer. And I think politicians are no different. But we do tend to hold them to a higher standard, especially when we're talking about issues related to politics. So when the commentator asked Amy Klobuchar the question about being unable to say or mention or recall the name of the president of Mexico, and she basically said, I made a mistake. Right. I'm sorry. And I think that people need to be willing to say they made mistakes and that they're sorry for them, and that the American public on the back end, in a normative sense, should be able to respect their apology. But in politics, we know that doesn't happen as often as maybe it should.
Well, Ryan, looks like you want to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that's certainly part of it. But I think a simpler explanation for Bloomberg not sounding very sincere is he isn't sincere. There was a report in The Intercept about how he apparently plagiarized big chunks of his campaign platform from news articles and other politicians. And there was a report in BuzzFeed a couple of days ago about how in an event in 2019, like less than a year ago, he has been talking about how calling transgender people, you know, he, she, or it, or, you know, or saying that Democrats talking about a dude in a dress is not a winning political issue. And now he's saying, oh, yeah, LGBTQ plus youth. I'm so worried about and like, come on. He's not apologizing, I think, because he doesn't think he did anything wrong, and he's just trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes.
Michael, is Mike Bloomberg cooked?
No, not close to it. No, he had a bad night. There's a lot more ahead. I mean, I think one of the interesting things here will be to see how he performs in the next debate. You know, there are lots of things to complain about with respect to the length of this campaign. It seems like it's been going on for years, and it's not even close to being over. One of the virtues of it is the candidates get better. The candidates who were on the stage, aside from Michael Bloomberg, were much better at performing in that chaotic format than they were at the beginning of the campaign. And it was his first time. He was totally unprepared for it. Now, he could have watched a couple of those previous debates. That's a remarkable fact.
Homework.
But there'll be another debate in South Carolina in a week. It'll be interesting to see whether he gets the wake-up call that everybody seems to think he should be getting.
You were saying, Michael, before going on the air, that you thought that Bernie Sanders really just was on his game last night.
He has a message. He knows his message. He sticks to his message. I think he has a way of, in my opinion, kind of slowing the conversation down, which was not easy to do last night when it's his turn to speak. And he hits his bullet points and gets them across, I think, in a way that the other candidates have more trouble doing, it seems to me.
Camille, we don't want to ignore the other candidates on the stage. There were five other people. But what did you make of just how they presented themselves? Was there someone there that you felt rose to the top or was on their game and was able to connect with the questions, the audience, the viewers?
I think last night Elizabeth Warren had a very standout performance, but she also needed that performance, especially given the recent polls that we've seen come out this week, where Bernie Sanders is leading in multiple states by double digits, with the exception of maybe two. So I think she did really well last night, coming out in force, speaking against Bloomberg, being very clear about some of her plans, trying to draw distinctions between her plans and the plans of other candidates. So I think if I'm looking at the debate stage, I think she did very well. I think Michael Bloomberg disappointed people in many ways. But as Michael said, who was actually paying attention to that? Are the folks that are listening to the campaign ads being persuaded also by the debate? Probably not. I think Joe Biden, didn't really have a great performance, fairly lackluster. The word salad continues. And so it's very hard to watch him as someone, when you're looking at the polls over time, who has suffered probably the greatest penalty in terms of also a double-digit decline across the states. Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. Pete Buttigieg had some great talking points, but was hot and cold. The same is true for Amy Klobuchar. So for me last night, if I'm thinking about who had great performances, Elizabeth Warren had a performance that she needed. And I also think Bernie Sanders did really well.
How about for you, Ryan?
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, Warren, this is by far her best performance. And the first we've seen of like classic Elizabeth Warren, you know, tearing into billionaire Hyde in months. And, you know, Bernie Sanders is in first place. They basically didn't talk about him that much.
No,
and
they didn't.
And that's good for him, you know, because someone needed to take him down and nobody even tried. But I think the other one that stood out to me is Pete Buttigieg. Because every other candidate, even Biden, whose politics are probably closest to Bloomberg, they're probably closer to Bloomberg than they are to Sanders, they just jumped on Bloomberg. They seemed personally offended at the idea that this guy is just going to buy the nomination like a Slurpee at 7-Eleven. But Pete Buttigieg, he stood back. He didn't join in on almost any of the big, you know, attack lines. And it seemed that he was sort of hedging his bets a little bit, you know, maybe thinking, cheeky VP nomination coming down the pike for me, maybe.
But that is his modus operandi, isn't it? I mean, he doesn't.
Squirmy.
Well, I mean, you can call it different things. I mean, I think he's very sort of careful and watchful and waits for those moments to jump in. Michael, you've got a quizzical look on your face.
He wants to position himself as the non-inflammatory candidate, right? The person who's going to bring the country together. And I think, you know, not attacking is a part of that strategy.
You think so as well, Camille?
I mean, so his attacks weren't directly to Bloomberg, but he and Amy Klobuchar were sparring last night.
That's true.
The entire night. So for me, I was just trying to understand what is the point of this battle happening over to the right?
It seemed to go on for remarkably long.
It was the
time.
Entire night, just back and forth. And so
didn't she at one point say, "Oh, you think you're so perfect?" Right?
There were all kinds of tiny little jabs. You think you're so perfect? You want to talk about how I can't remember the name of the president of Mexico, but you're not even in the room making decisions about foreign policy. There were just a lot of moments. And part of, in my thinking, like, where's this pettiness coming from? Maybe a few debates ago when she says to his face, if I were just a mayor as a woman, there's no way that I would make it on this stage. And so maybe that's where some of these jabs are coming from. But it lasted for a while. So although he wasn't laser focused on Bloomberg, he and Amy Klobuchar were going at it.
That's true.
Ryan, hold that thought only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking about last night's Democratic debate in Las Vegas, the caucuses are on Saturday. Talking with Camille Burge, and she's assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. Michael Hagan, associate professor of political science at Temple University. And Ryan Cooper, national correspondent for The Week. We want to hear from you. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play another clip from last night's debate. This is Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg in an exchange about whether billionaires should exist. Sanders is a self-described democratic socialist, and Bloomberg, as we all know, is a billionaire.
We have a grotesque and immoral distribution of wealth and income. Mike Bloomberg owns more wealth than the bottom 125 million Americans. That's wrong. That's immoral. That should not be the case when we got 500,000 people sleeping out on the streets, where we have kids who cannot afford to go to college, when we have 45 million people dealing with student debt. We have enormous problems facing this country, and we cannot continue seeing a situation where in the last 3 years, billionaires in this country saw an $850 billion increase in their wealth. Congratulations, Mr. Bloomberg. But the average American last year saw less than a 1% increase in his or her income. That's wrong.
Mayor Bloomberg, should you exist?
I can't speak for all billionaires. All I know is I've been very lucky, made a lot of money, and I'm giving it all away to make this country better. And a good chunk of it goes to the Democratic Party as well.
Is it too much? Have you earned too much money? Has it been an obscene amount of money? Should you have earned that much money?
Yes. I worked very hard for it, and I'm giving it away.
Well, let me get back to our guests here. And, Ryan, you want to weigh in on that? Let me just add one more little thing, because Bernie Sanders went on to say, and I thought this was actually quite interesting, that in this country, he says, we have socialism. We have socialism for the very rich. We have rugged individualism for the poor. What is his message about being a socialist, which he is?
Yeah, I mean, he basically says, you know, that America should be changed into something like the European social democracies. And for the most part, that's not what would classically be called socialism. You know, he's talking about blowing out a big full dress welfare state, paid leave, more Social Security, Medicare for all the benefits that people love in those countries. But he also has a proposal for what they call worker ownership funds, in which publicly traded companies over a certain market cap, which is like most of the big ones, would have to set aside 20% of their stock for a fund that would be owned and controlled by the workers of that company. And so they would receive the dividends and they would be able to vote the shares. And then he has a proposal as well to put workers on the corporate boards of companies. Elizabeth Warren supports that one as well. And that's another classic. You know, Germany has that one. A lot of the Nordics do as well. And so, you know, you're talking about making society basically a more gentle place. What I would sort of dispute the characterization of socialism as when you do these sort of corrupt bailouts, like what happened in 2008. I would just say is just corrupt. You know, it's you maybe you could call it Soviet communism type of thing, where the state just stuffs money into a failing enterprise. But democratic socialism is more about, you know, the whole of society being cut in on the fruits of economic production.
Let me go to you, Michael, and also to you, Camille, though. But it is interesting to think of the Democratic Party having, as it stands now, at least the two leaders, based on the polls, on the one hand, you've got Democratic Socialists, you've got Bernie Sanders, and on the other hand, you've got billionaire Michael Bloomberg, all within the same tent.
One of the things I kept trying to force myself to do as I watched the debate last night is to think about the reaction of somebody who hadn't been paying any attention to politics to this point. This was their first exposure. And one of the things that person would have to wonder is what the Democratic Party stands for, the range of personalities and styles as well as policies on the stage was pretty wide. And so it speaks to the ongoing question about what the parties stand for and what control, if any, the parties ought to exert over this process of choosing a presidential candidate. They seem to have very little.
Yeah. And it's interesting with Michael Bloomberg, and I'm going to just quote Jamel Bowie, who had an interesting piece in the New York Times talking about him. He may have been a Republican, but he's also a liberal. He's given hundreds of millions of dollars to liberal causes and Democratic politicians, and he goes on from there, which is, I think, for a lot of Democrats, creates a kind of a crisis of conscience about who is this person. With all this money.
Right. A crisis of conscience about who is this person. But going back to the question, like, what does this party stand for? So there's been a growing bifurcation within the Democratic Party in terms of the party either moving in a more progressive wing, or should they go towards the center to help pick up those more moderate Republicans or independents who might not feel so comfortable going as far to the left? We saw this breakdown with the Republican Party happening in 2010 with the emergence of the Tea Party Republicans. And so Democrats are really feeling this. They started feeling this, I think, in 2016 more recently. You could see it again in the 2018 midterms. And right now, there is a war for what does the party stand for? How far to the left will the party go? Or will the party move more towards the middle. And I think the fact that both of these candidates in more recent polling are coming out in the top two or the top three reflects that growing uncertainty among the rank and file as well.
And is it because they're trying to figure out who is the person to beat Donald Trump? And I don't know if any of those people on the stage, Michael, last night exhibited whatever those qualities are.
I don't claim to have a special knowledge of what those qualities are either, but I would say that one of the struggles here is connecting up policy with labels and symbols. So Ryan's talking about what Sanders advocates in terms of policy proposals and whether that constitutes socialism or not. Donald Trump just wants to label Bernie Sanders a socialist,
right.
And he has one of the leaders of Venezuela or one of the opposition leaders in Venezuela at the State of the Union speech in order to emphasize what socialism is from Trump's point of view, which is just bad. That doesn't really have a lot of close connection to policies.
Let me read. Hold on one second. Let me just read a couple of comments, Camille, and then I'll go back to you. A Facebook comment from Evelyn. I will vote in the primaries for the person who I think would make a good president. There's no gaming the system to get the most, quote unquote, electable candidate. A Facebook comment from Gary. This must be from last night. Sanders grabbed my attention in 2016 with the issues he was putting out there for consideration. I've been on board since, and I'm ecstatic to see his early successes. Another Facebook comment from Evan. So it takes a billionaire Republican oligarch to beat a billionaire Republican oligarch. And I never thought I'd ask this question, but are all billionaires the same, Camille?
I don't think so. And I think we've seen that, especially on the Democratic stage, thinking about Tom Steyer, who was not on the stage last night. Mm-hmm. Also someone who has a great deal of wealth. Michael Bloomberg, another person who has a great deal of wealth. So I don't think it would be fair to label them all paint them all with the same brush. They're different. Everyone's not the same. But to go back to the comment about electability and some
yes.
of these comments that individuals are raising online, the Democratic Party has an interesting charge ahead of them. They have a very diverse coalition under their umbrella. So you have African Americans, you have members of the Latinx community, LGBTQIA+, suburban white women, and unwed white women with children. That's the party. If you're lucky enough to bring these people back in line, working class white voters who want to support the Democratic Party for labor union purposes. But that's another story.
Right.
So they have an interesting task ahead of them to figure out the meta language that appeals to all of these coalitions. And so right now what we're seeing is maybe the people that are on stage have not exactly figured out that meta language. So what we see is quite a bit of pandering to all of these different coalitions, and then a change of message when they're going in front of different people, which is what you would somewhat expect in a presidential campaign or any electoral capacity. But there is a meta language here that I think Bernie Sanders is tapping into that appeals to the masses, that appeals to the coalition, which is regardless of your race, we all need to be concerned about wage stagnation. We all need to be concerned about some of the more economic issues like healthcare, those things are issues for every person that's under this umbrella. And so if we're all interested in fixing these economic issues that affect everyone under this umbrella, then that's how we're going to move forward. And that's why I think the message, resonates with a lot of people.
Well, healthcare has really dominated just about all the debates. I mean, it took up a lot of time yesterday, I think legitimately so, because people say they care about healthcare and the costs and coverage and all of that. But I thought it was interesting, Ryan, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said recently, a president can't wave a magic wand and pass any legislation they want, basically saying perhaps there is some compromise. This is to Bernie Sanders, some compromise on Medicare for all. He said, I love Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's done more in her first year in Congress to transform politics. But my view is that Medicare for all, the bill that we wrote, is in a sense a compromise. It's a four-year transition period. But he's basically saying, take it or leave it, in a sense. I mean, this is what I believe in, and there is no compromise.
I don't think that's quite true. I think you're seeing a negotiation strategy from Bernie there. Despite his reputation as a sort of like pie-in-the-sky radical, he's been a deal cutter for decades. And he's gotten all sorts of little compromises in. He got community health centers, money in Obamacare. He got this Yemen bill through the House and the Senate. If you're looking ahead at passing a bill like that, a really big, aggressive healthcare reform, you know, you want to aim high so that when the conservatives in the party start nipping away at it, you still have something pretty good at the end of that, hopefully. Mm. But you can't say that out front that I'm willing to accept something less than my goal. You have to lay your marker down and stick to it until it comes time to actually count votes. And then, you know, you can start talking about, well, this is the best we can get and so on. But, AOC, God bless her, has not been in Congress for, 30 years.
No.
And so, I think she may be a little bit, sort of giving the game away to some degree. But still, again, the point, though, if you can get Medicare for All, absolutely he would take that in a second. And so, that's the idea in my view.
Michael, let me go back to you. It looks like you want to say something. Let me just toss something out. But if Mitch McConnell is in control of the Senate, does anything pass that any of these people are presenting?
It seems pretty unlikely. It certainly would require deal-making of the sort that Ryan's talking about. The problem with the presidential nominating process is it's not a process that encourages deal-making. That's what we're seeing right now. It's not about building a coalition. It's about mobilizing a faction of the party, especially when there are 6 or 8 or 24 candidates or whatever. You don't need to win a majority of the votes in order to win the nomination. In fact, that's the wrong way to go. The way to go is to energize a fraction large enough to get yourself rolling, as Sanders seems to be doing right now.
Yeah. I mean, he's got 30% of the vote in some of the 30-some percent in the latest polls, but that means that 60% don't want him.
And that's the story about the 2016 presidential nomination. It delivered the process has delivered us two candidates who were reviled by 60%, each of which was reviled by 60% of the electorate.
Ryan, you want to say something?
The thing, Sanders polls pretty well, though. His approval rating is like 10 to 15 points, the net approval rating 10 to 15 points ahead of Trump. And within the Democratic Party, if you look at the Morning Consult poll, he polls at 74% approval among Democratic voters. And that is not only pretty good, it's the highest of any candidate. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people who are clearly nervous about Sanders, but they like what he's saying. It's not like he's turning everyone off. They just think they're just scared of him because he sounds like he's too aggressive. But if he turned, I think that if he did win, they would absolutely line up behind him.
But Camille, Warren seems to be saying, yes, we need the sort of core of the Democratic Party, but we have to win over independents. We have to even win over Republicans if we're going to win in November.
She absolutely is saying that. And what was interesting to me last night is there were a few times in which she even backed down off of some of her more hardline stances and made statements along the lines of it's okay for compromise, whereas in previous debates, Amy Klobuchar was taking on Elizabeth Warren for not being willing to compromise. So we already see Elizabeth Warren, I think, backing down some of this hard line language. And just to agree with Ryan, I also think that that what Bernie Sanders is doing is quite effective. And so it's something that but the fear of the people is there, particularly of establishment Democrats. And so what I've been noticing on some of the more liberal-leaning networks are Democrats already starting to slander Bernie Sanders and talking about, like, this will never work, his chances are slim. And so that's been interesting to observe over the last couple of days as well as these new polls have come out showing that he is in the lead.
Let me play a clip from, and this is Pete Buttigieg, that's number four. Okay, Pete Buttigieg, and again on the debate stage last night. And here he is criticizing both Senator Sanders and Mayor Bloomberg for straying from the traditional Democratic Party.
So we've got to wake up as a party. We could wake up 2 weeks from today, the day after Super Tuesday, and the only candidates left standing will be Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg, the two most polarizing figures on this stage. And most Americans don't see where they fit if they've got to choose between a socialist who thinks that capitalism is the root of all evil and a billionaire who thinks that money ought to be the root of all power. Let's put forward somebody who actually lives and works in a middle-class neighborhood in an industrial Midwestern city. Let's put forward somebody who's actually a Democrat.
Camille, is he onto something?
I mean, maybe he's onto something for himself because...
He would be that guy.
He would be that guy. He would be that guy. But again, the polls, if you're looking at any of the polls that are released this week, Pete Buttigieg is polling in single digits.
Yeah.
Throughout especially most of the Super Tuesday states, with the exception of maybe two or three states. So he's talking about himself here. He's trying to give the American people on this stage a reason to maybe... take another look at him, to reconsider what they're currently thinking with these two individuals as the front runner. And is that really what the party wants?
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I to go back to the point about electability, I think electability is very important. And the reason that there's been so much fluctuation in the polls over the past 2 months, it's not unusual for this process, but it's unusual for any other process, is that people are trying to make a judgment about who might win. And for that reason, I think actually the outcome of the Nevada caucus is going to be enormously more important than this debate, because we saw Buttigieg take a big rise in the – enjoy a big rise in the polls in New Hampshire following Iowa. That could happen in South Carolina and or the Super Tuesday states following the Nevada caucuses, I think. And the Nevada caucuses are very difficult to predict, so I just think there's a lot of water yet to go under the bridge.
I think you could say that. All the cliches that kind of fall apart when we say them. Ryan, we're almost up at a break, but I know you want to say something.
Yeah, just real quickly on this point that Bernie is not a Democrat in the same way that Bloomberg is not a Democrat. I mean, that's just hogwash. You know, Bernie has been an independent, and it's just a fussiness on his part that he's caucused with the Democrats for his entire career. And he indeed was the only one on stage who pointed out that Bloomberg was a Republican in 2004 who endorsed George W. Bush and supported the Iraq War. So, you know, who's the party loyalist now, Pete?
Okay, fair enough. That is Ryan Cooper, and again, national correspondent for the week. Also with us, Camille Burr. She's assistant professor of political science at Villanova University. Michael Hagan with us as well. He's an associate professor of political science at Temple University. And we have convened this trio of guests to talk about last night's Democratic primary debate in Las Vegas. The caucuses, I think it's a plural, the caucuses are on Saturday. There's another debate. There's Super Tuesday coming up in just a couple of weeks. Much to talk about, certainly related to the Democratic Party. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Let me read some more comments. One from Kirk, who says Sanders has had a consistent message for the last 30 years. I know a few Trump supporters who also like Bernie, as well as many independents and libertarians. Here's a tweet so far this morning. I have read that everyone on this stage, except for Bloomberg, won. Everyone saw what they wanted to in the Rorschach debate. An email from Joan. In every debate, Mayor Pete's rhetoric is slick and surface. He accuses others of not having a plan, but he himself never relays specifics. A comment from Dave. Bernie doesn't need to win the most delegates. He just needs to come close. Then he can offer the vice presidency to whoever comes close from there. Let me play one more clip from last night. This is an edited clip of Elizabeth Warren asking Michael Bloomberg to release the women from their non-disclosure agreements who have alleged sexual harassment at his company. You'll also hear Joe Biden jumping in at the end.
The mayor has to stand on his record. And what we need to know is exactly what's lurking out there. He has gotten some number of women, dozens, who knows, to sign non-disclosure agreements, both for sexual harassment and for gender discrimination in the workplace. So, Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements so we can hear their side of the story?
We have a very few non-disclosure agreements.
How many is that?
Let me finish.
How many is that?
None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like a joke I told. And let me put, there's agreements between two parties that wanted to keep it quiet. and that's up to them.
It's easy. All the mayor has to do is say, you are released from the non-disclosure agreement. Period.
Camille, but this is to all of you, in light of the Me Too movement, in light of a president who has been accused of sexual harassment and more, this is such an important issue. Can you speak to that and speak to Mike Bloomberg's response? Clearly, Warren was ready to go last night. She had her weapons at her hand.
I agree with that. And so the response, part of it, I've been nice to some women. That was part of what Mayor Bloomberg said. Maybe they didn't like a joke that I have, but we've entered into consensual agreements, as we were talking about just before the commercial break. None of these comments are satisfactory, especially in the age of Me Too. And so we have to think about the context and in which we're operating right now. And Elizabeth Warren, from the first 3.5 minutes into the debate, we knew that she was going to come after Michael Bloomberg for his record on gender discrimination as well as sexual harassment. And so to bring those things to light and then to translate it and say, and here's why it matters. Because when we're talking about women, especially in this age of Me Too, we have to think about all of the women that are looking for the Democratic Party to champion their issues. And is this someone that you want at the helm of the party to help champion those issues? And to what extent are they capable of doing so if they have not demonstrated this behavior in the past? And so I think she, in that moment, for me, as I was watching the debate, was a real turning point in her performance. Mm. And I think is one of those moments in the debate where if people were uncertain about who they should support, that perhaps if they were leaning away from Elizabeth Warren, now they might be giving her a second look.
And women in the Democratic Party, and also African-American women in the Democratic Party, play the key role.
Exactly. When we're looking at turnout rates, especially in the midterm elections.
What did you make of this interchange, Michael? Is it important?
Yes, I think it is. And think about it from a strategic point of view. I'm wondering now whether the candidates other than Bloomberg have enough to produce a pretty fair number of negative ads, of ads featuring some of the missteps that some would say Bloomberg made during this appearance. So it'll be interesting to see whether that is a turn that the debate, that the campaign takes now as Bloomberg has sort of emerged onto the stage, so to speak.
I mean, Biden said to him, just do it. Just release these women, Ryan.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment. I mean, Elizabeth Warren certainly kind of stuck the knife in, but Biden really, he kind of came and backed her up right there. And he pointed out, you know, Bloomberg is making this preposterous characterization of how these NDAs work. You know, it's basically a hush money payment in most cases. Somebody did a horrible thing. They sue, the victim sues, and then they go to court and the boss or the rich person or whatever, they pay a bunch of money for it to go away and never come back. And if you go, like the Washington Post had an article about all this stuff, just detailing the list of stuff that Bloomberg is publicly known to have said, or, you know, is documented in court documents and so on. And it's horrible, horrible stuff. I probably can't even repeat it on the air. But, you know, for him to say that, oh, this, we just, you know, it was a bad joke or something like that, it's nonsense. And I think that if voters are looking for someone who could beat Trump, what Bloomberg does is immediately throws all that gender stuff out the window, like all the attacks on Trump about his record of sexual assault and rape, because he'll be able to point to the nominee and be, look at these hypocrite Democrats. They think that they say they care about women and Me Too and all that stuff, and then they nominate this guy, and look at this, and it just completely deflates the attack, and, you know, it's certainly worth considering.
Let me get Ed from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Question regarding Warren's tactics last night. I thought, as people have said, she had an effective debate. But it felt as though she was going after exclusively Bloomberg. He's not even on the ballot in Nevada. And really, isn't she in the same lane as Bernie? And wouldn't that be the individual that she has to try to corral voters from? So it didn't really make sense to me, her tactical approach to that debate.
It's an interesting question. I'm going to toss it to you, Michael.
It was interesting. I was surprised that she didn't draw more distinctions between herself and Sanders, but she is committed to that, to some of the same programs, some of the same policy proposals and so forth. So much of campaigning these days is defining yourself not vis-a-vis people who are near you politically, but vis-a-vis people who are on the other side or opposed mm-hmm. to you, saying, I am not that person right there. And I think she was – so I guess she was focused on making that distinction between herself and Bloomberg.
Do you think she also wants Sanders voters? I mean, I think –
Well, it makes it more difficult for her to attack Sanders and attract Sanders voters at the same time, sure.
Camille, let me pick up on something that we just mentioned earlier, which is here we are, what, six candidates, all white, even the ones who didn't make the stage, basically all white. And here is a diverse Democratic Party. First of all, I guess, how did this happen? Which could take a full hour. But what does that mean?
So how does this happen? And then what does that mean? So I think when you're looking at polling, especially in the primaries, we have to think about who our samples are in these polls. And the overwhelming majority of the time, most of these samples are made up of a majority of white Americans. We do a pretty terrible job polling racial and ethnic minorities and including them in the numbers. So even when you're talking about who's making it to the stage based on these polling numbers, if our samples consist of largely white Americans, then that's going to skew even who we're getting the opportunity to hear from. So I think we have to be quite a bit more conscious about the way we conduct polls, about who's included in those samples, and think about who might be excluded and what that might mean as we try to set the stage for the candidates that might still be viable or that might mm-hmm. still be available. So that's in part, I think, in part, we could go on again for hours for the how. But the what does this mean for the party? What I find incredibly interesting is you have a number of these politicians on stage jockeying to say they've done the least racist things, right? And so it is Black History Month. So when we're thinking about some words of Dr. Martin Luther King that we don't often discuss, he did warn of the moderate white liberal. He knew where the Klansmen stood. But what do we make of the moderate white liberal who comes into the communities of color just to get the vote and then abandons the communities of color and doesn't take upon their agenda or only talks about their agenda in terms of criminal justice as if there's no intersectionality as it pertains to environmental racism and environmental justice? So there are a number of issues that I think the Democratic Party has to confront as it pertains to race relations that include the criminal justice system, but also include all of the other issues that people of color are concerned about that deal with the economy, that deal with taxes, that deal with healthcare, that deal with the environment. And so what I find really suspect right now and seemingly disingenuous is every candidate on that stage trying to say they've done the least racist thing, particularly that of Joe Biden, who is the sole author of the crime bill. So if you're going to come after Michael Bloomberg for stop and frisk, let's talk about your record on race as well and what that means for mass incarceration, but they all have work to do.
Well, and it's interesting that you're seeing Black support for Biden beginning to fall away. It might be a generational thing. Ryan, you want to weigh in on that? And then we'll get back to some more comments.
Yeah. And from what I can tell, the support is mainly flowing to Sanders, who is really, he got absolutely rinsed among Black voters in the South in 2016. That was what sunk his primary campaign. And he's really been working on that, you could tell. He's hired a lot of Black advisors and built out his racial justice platform and talks about it quite consistently. But the thing about the whole winnowing down the whole field to a bunch of white people, though I will note that both Bloomberg and Bernie are Jewish, which is not nothing. That's an important identity characteristic, surely. There were a whole bunch of chances for Black candidates like Booker or Latino candidates like Julian Castro to sort of catch fire, but the minority vote went elsewhere. You see today in Nevada, the last poll I saw, Bernie was winning the Latino vote in Nevada by like 50 points, not even close. And we'll see how that flows when the actual votes come in. But, it appears that those communities more or less made their pick after, from the start.
Mike, you want to weigh in, and then we'll read some more comments.
Just briefly, it's worth pointing out that the Trump campaign seems to be making some gestures in the direction of the African-American community that I think are unexpected. I would not have
criminal
expected.
Criminal justice, think that kind of
thing? Well, and the Super Bowl ad featuring an African-American woman whom the president pardoned or whose sentence he commuted, I'm not sure which. And some other things, in some other respects. It seems to me that the Trump campaign, you know, it may just be a pipe dream. I don't know that they have any real reason to believe this could happen, but they seem to believe that they have some chance of picking up some votes in the African-American community, which is something the Democrats have to be concerned about.
Yeah, time will tell. Let me read some more comments. One from Tina. It seems like Bloomberg is rising because of Democratic money. Top leaders are desperate to find an alternative to Bernie. The party needs to drop Bloomberg. Facebook comment from Katie. Voters thought Hillary was the most electable candidate. Bernie is more than double points in the lead. Why are voters focusing on the most electable candidate when it failed in the last election? An email from Judy. It's time for Democrats to stop the debates. They're only making all of the candidates look bad. A better format would be an hour-long interview with each candidate. Camille, you had a visceral reaction to Judy's comment there. I mean, do the debates, we should hear people debate, whether it's messy or more light than heat or heat than light.
We should hear people debate, but people should also watch the debates. So going back to a comment that Michael made earlier, who's tuning in, particularly when you have so many other things you could be watching and things that are competing for our attention? The debates are not going to end. I think what commentators and networks could do to make debates more substantive is not start off by saying we want you to directly engage with one another, which were the part of the instructions at the beginning of the debate last night. Instead, maybe we want each person to have their full minute and a half. Please don't raise your hand. We'll call on you when we're ready for your response. If someone invokes your name, you can respond. So exercising a bit more civility so that we can hear from these people. Mm-hmm. So we're going to continue the debates, but maybe it's debates and some networks are doing this with town halls to hear more from these candidates. But certainly there could be other avenues where we could hear more substance from these individuals.
Ryan, do you think the debates help President Trump?
Maybe a bit. I don't know. The party's got to make its selection somehow. You know, everyone would like to have sort of kumbaya moment where everyone just gets behind the clear leader. But, you know, there are ideological disagreements about, you know, where things could go. And you got to hash that out in some way. What I will say, though, is that the party really should stop letting the TV networks run these things. You know, that it's up to them. They could have it. Do PBS and C-SPAN come on WHYY, ask substantive questions, and not these cable news airheads who are just asking the most controversial questions, you know, and backed by a corporate behemoth that has a direct financial incentive to keep Trump in office. You know, it's just baffling to me that they allow, you know, the networks to have any role in this at all.
Keep him in office because of ratings, you're saying?
Taxes.
Meaning?
Well, sorry. Democrats come up, they're going to raise taxes on corporations and Comcast and all the other big, you know, telecom monopolies will be paying billions more in tax money. And, you know, it's not to say it's a conspiracy, but like that is a type of thing that can certainly influence the way that people talk about and the way they think about their coverage.
Michael, I'm giving you the last word. We're almost out of time here.
The debate format is not one that encourages debate about policy. I mean, I gather the candidates were limited to a minute and 15 seconds to respond to the question. You can't develop an idea in a minute and 15 seconds. Maybe it'll get more people involved in politics, this kind of show. But in terms of making us understand what people are really about and who might make the better president is they have something, they leave something to be desired, I think.
Well, we've got to leave it there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Hagan, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. Camille Burge, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Villanova University. And Ryan Cooper, National Correspondent for The Week. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.